I'm going to start off this workshop. I'm going to chair it, but I want to just talk a little about the situation. We said Iraq, Iran, Syria, Yemen and beyond, Libya. I knew I forgot something. Basically, the endless imperial wars in the Middle East and challenging them. And so I want to say that since 2007, I visited Iran twice. I went to Syria last spring for the to look at the election as an election observer. And it's interesting how things weave together. I also spent a month in Sulaymaniyah, Iraq. But it's the first time I went to Iran, the NIE report that said that the Iranians were not building a nuclear bomb and had no interest in doing so came out while I was in Tehran. And there was like people were dancing in the streets like, ha ha, we were right, and see the experts understand us. So and then the second time I went to Iran, I was sitting in my motel room the day before I flew out of New York with, and we were watching TV, and we saw that forces from the West, NATO forces, had just bombed the Gaddafi's compound and killed his young son and his grandchildren. And we were like mortified, like here we are, American representatives going over to Iran, and the latest news is that our country's forces just killed a bunch of civilians in a compound and are celebrating having done so. And it was just really this horrible feeling. And every time I travel there, I find people who are full of optimism and looking forward to building a better future in their countries. And I come back here and I find out what the next terrible thing that's planned for them is. And the worst one was I came back from Syria last June, and people were so full of optimism after the election because it was a referendum of sorts. And they said, we want our government, we want an end to all this, we want our lives back. And I came back here, and 2 weeks later or less, I hear that ISIS is on the move and that they just picked up a whole bunch of weapons in Mosul and they're taking them back to Syria. And again, it's just another, and I realized that the attack on these countries is endless. It's just endless, and that if it looks like they're gaining some ground in restabilizing, immediately an action is taken to undermine any progress that's happening there. Now I'm just going to talk about challenging all this in terms of Yemen, and I hope this isn't too chaotic for you. So we see the progression of the wars, and they've all been covert. Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. These are all organizations funded, armed, and promoted throughout the Gulf Emirates, in Saudi Arabia by the fabulously wealthy Saudi princes, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. Throughout that region, these organizations are funded and supported. Qatar was for a long time and may still be paying the salaries of Al-Nusra Front and some of the other Syrian organizations that are fighting the government. So just to be brief, so I when I heard about that they were actually overtly attacking in Yemen, I was stunned. And I, so I said, well, I have to do something about this. So I wrote a petition, and I said, it came to mind that maybe instead of going after the U.S. government directly, especially in this case, that we should actually try and cut off the power of their cat's paws, so to speak, of their proxies. So why not actually target Saudi Arabia in this particular instance, because they're doing such an egregious violation of international law. So I said, I'll write a petition to the a Security Council in the United Nations. So I wrote this petition, and I'm going to just read you part of it. And then what I'm going to do is I'm sending it to the Security Council because Ban Ki-moon has no power whatsoever. But there are members of the Security Council, for instance, Venezuela, along with Russia and China, who really don't want this war to go on. So I, I wrote this petition and I said, given that over 1,000 people, mostly civilian, including 100 children, have been killed by the Saudi bombing campaign in Yemen and thousands more injured, more than 100,000 people displaced beginning since the beginning of the campaign, the United States has regularly bombed Yemeni communities with drones. David Swanson asked me to add that. Saudi Arabia has bombed the Houthi homelands in northern Yemen for decades. Saudi Arabia has fought six wars for control of Yemen. Prior to the bombing campaign, there was indeed a conflict in Yemen, but the Houthis had not engaged in attacks on civilians and the destruction of homes, farms, factories, fuel supplies, and other infrastructure. The Houthis have been the only force on the ground mounting a successful resistance to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. Since the bombing began, AQAP had reemerged and was mounting devastating attacks. And so I went on and I talked about how the Houthis didn't ask to take over the government. They said they wanted a unity government. And here the Saudis are bombing this country on the basis that, you know, somehow these bad guy Houthis, who happen to be the indigenous people of the country, are an enemy. So I said that young Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is now the defense minister in Saudi Arabia, I said that if he doesn't immediately stand down, they should refer him to the ICC, because this is something that the Security Council has special ability to do. So I got like between 1,500 and 2,000 signatures. I printed everything up. I faxed it to all the embassies. I did all this stuff. And then I found out that the day before that, in the Security Council, the United States had passed a resolution condemning the Houthis, the indigenous people of Yemen, for defending their country and for wanting to participate in the government. So I realized that you just can't be fast enough to get ahead of these guys. And I wanted to talk a little then, just briefly, about the United States action since then, which is that the United States, in the middle, before there was any danger, when the Houthis were in Sana'a, trying to negotiate with through the United Nations to have their unity government with Hadi, with the ex-president Hadi, whose mandate had already expired, the United States and the UK closed their embassies and said it's too dangerous for us to stay here and there's nothing going on except a negotiation at that point. So they did that. So Hadi took his cue, and this is the ex-president of Yemen, and he jumped up and he ran down to Aden, where apparently he's supremely unpopular. So he didn't last there very long, and he's tried to form a government there, but he's not well liked there. So then he took off for Saudi Arabia. So what did the United States then do? They heard that Al-Qaeda was resurgent because, you know, now we got the whole Saudi army. We got the Al-Qaeda foot soldiers and we got the bombing campaign from the main government. So they're working together and the AQAP forces are outside the U.S. drone base in Yemen. So what did they do? They vacated it and they took their people. And within 24 hours, AQAP took over the U.S. drone base. Who knows how many weapons are on there? Fortunately, Al-Qaeda rarely does anything in the air. Even when they take over airports, they destroy the aircraft. They don't fly them. So here they are. They actually handed over their base to Al-Qaeda. And then they refused an unbelievable decision to evacuate American citizens while the bombing was going on. So here thousands of people are being killed in the cities across Yemen. They're being reduced to rubble. There's no food and water. It's rapidly deteriorating. And the United States refuses to evacuate their personnel. And I just, this whole chain of events is kind of just shocking in its bizarreness. So on that note, I guess I will say one more thing about the ship. The Iranians sent an aid ship to Yemen a couple of weeks ago, or whatever that was, a week ago, and it was turned back by the United States blockade. And a ceasefire that had been called was rescinded by the Saudi government, and they started bombing again, and they blamed Iran for sending an aid ship. That's their excuse for bombing again. So now, yesterday they launched another Red Crescent ship, and there are a bunch of Americans and Europeans on that ship, kind of like the flotillas to Gaza. They have powdered milk and powdered milk, rice, and medical supplies on the ship. And so a bunch of people, and they set off to Saudi Arabia with a military escort. And I saw on my iPhone before it died this morning that Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States, is calling for a truce. So perhaps the launching that ship actually did its work. So anyway, on that note, I'm going to start calling on some other people. I'm just giving some context. Other people are going to evaluate. And the first person I'm going to call on is Johnny Achi, who is with Syrian Arab, with Arabs for Syria. In this country, Arab Americans for Syria. He has been to Syria six times since 2011 on fact-finding missions. He took a bunch of Americans on more than one occasion. And he's been going back and forth to get the real story for us of what's happening in Syria. And so I give you Johnny.
Thank you, Julie. It's an honor being on this panel with everyone here. Great seeing you, Cynthia, again. Cynthia, of course, did go with us to Syria in September of 2013 when the U.S. Was trying to bomb Syria. What I'd like to talk about today, two very important points we didn't get a chance to talk about yesterday. One point is, of course, one of the biggest lies that the United States administration has been trying to convince the world about Syria is that the majority of Syrians would like to change what's going on in Syria. And I remember Syria for 50 years has been on the Eastern Bloc. We just, not by choice, basically United States, France, and Britain decided to side with the State of Israel against the Palestinian people. And Syria, of course, chose to support the resistance of the Palestinian people, chose to support the resistance of the Lebanese people against the expansionist policy of the State of Israel. That's where the problem lies. There is no revolution in Syria. Yes, everybody wanted reform, but we want to keep the status quo. We did not want to become another puppet. We did not want to kneel to the imperialist capitalist regimes of the West. We've always chosen to stay where we are. We like to be independent. We like to be sovereign. And this is the demand, and this is what every single Syrian really wanted to be. The majority, the United States administration insisted that the majority wanted that big change, and they were part of this revolution. This is, was the biggest obstacle for us here in the United States, to show the world, not on the, on the contrary, the majority are with their army, with their government, they are with peace, and that we wanted stability. The idea was to destabilize Syria from the get-go. We wanted to stay the way we were, security, peace to us, that what meant freedom is. Last year's election, presidential election, not everybody talked, hardly anyone talks about this, and it's a very important point because it was the biggest blow to the U.S. administration. Not what happened inside of Syria on June 3rd. We went down there, we voted, because they prevented us from going to the Syrian embassy here in Washington on the eve, almost 2 days before. They realized we had a Facebook page. They knew we were going up in the thousands to Washington to voice our opinion to vote for Bashar Assad. Of course, the opposition had boycotted the election. So anyone who's going to go to the embassies around the world, he's going to be voting, obviously, for the current regime. In Dubai, there was maybe 20 or 30,000 people who have signed up to go. Again, on the eve of the election, they denied them the right to go. So we, on a 24 hours notice, decided to go to Syria. What they were trying to avoid is the scene they saw in Beirut 5 days earlier. Beirut's Syrian embassy was pretty much attacked. There was hundreds of thousands of Syrians who marched to the embassy to vote for Bashar Assad. This scene was the biggest blow to the American administration, who was insisting that everyone in Syria wanted done with this criminal killer, this army that kills its people. The Syrians in Lebanon, just to remind you, supposed to have been on the opposition. All these supposed to have been refugees running away from the monstrous killers of the Syrian army, who's bombing its own people, and Bashar Assad, who's killing his own people. So by European estimates, by Sky News, 800,000 people marched to the Syrian embassy. 800,000 people blocked, clogged the streets of Lebanon from all parts, north and south. There was no more life in Beirut. All you see was a sea of people carrying the pictures of Bashar Assad going to the embassy to vote. They had to extend for 2 days more, promising them that everybody will get to vote. These were women with children walking for miles. Wow. These are the people who are running away from this dictator are marching. And this is not in Damascus, so we can say, oh, they're forced to go vote. This is in Beirut, in Lebanon. They don't have to do it. But they wanted to show the world, we're not running away from our government. We're running away from these mercenaries that you've sent to kill us at home. This is one very important point I wanted to make. The second point, I want to move on to ISIS. And Judy did talk about Saudi Arabia. We want to remind you guys that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was released from American Buka camp in Baghdad. Him and a bunch of other were released in 2006 at the same time when the U.S. Bush administration had announced its plan for the new Middle East, a plan which would employ sectarian violence as part of a process they called creative destruction. 2006, when Baghdadi was released from prison, when he became the Khalifa in 2010, he became the Khalifa of, at the time, the Islamic State of Iraq only, ISI. His first day at the job was about 40 bombs, did not attack a single American soldier. All 40 bombs were against Shiite shrines and Shiite market and Shiite souk. This is the plans that the United States had for us, sectarian violence. And they carried it over to Syria. They wanted to hit the arc of resistance. They wanted to employ ISIS and Al-Qaeda, fundamentalist Wahhabi ideology, to weaken Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and obviously Iran. Okay, we've resisted. Syria does not have a civil war. People living in Damascus, over 5 million, and in tremendous harmony. Anytime when you have these mercenaries go into a town in Syria, yes, violence and chaos take place. Yes, sectarian violence happen. Yes, they slaughter people. But this is on the hand of these mercenaries. We move on to ISIS, the ideology of the Wahhabists. Hillary Clinton in a congressional hearing reminded the senators that yes, these people we're fighting today are the same people we financed 20 years ago. This is by US administration, it's not something we're telling you. Martin Dempsey, just a few weeks ago on CNN, said, we know who support ISIS, we know who created ISIS, they're our allies in the region. So it's not a secret that Saudi Arabia and Qatari and this Wahhabist regimes are the ones. ISIS is funded by billions of dollars. This is, it's a huge entity. If it takes coalition of 40 people, 1 minute, to defeat this ISIS. ISIS is a monster created by these regimes to weaken Syria. Syria standing still is frustrating the West, and that's why now they created what they call a war on ISIS. They had a coalition and consists from the same countries who've created ISIS. They want to convince us that Saudi Arabia is in the coalition to defeat ISIS. They're using it as a pretext to violate Syrian airspace, people. This is what they wanted, a pretext for a proxy war. They failed every way. Now they want to use this as pretext, and this when people tell me, but America is going to help you to fight ISIS. I said, no. Just stop the funding of ISIS, and the Syrian Arab Army will take care of it. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So our next speaker is Ray McGovern. Ray, as you all know, is a veteran. I thought I actually added one thing to his bio, which is that he's a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. I love that title. You know, Veterans for Sanity. It's even better than Veterans for Peace. And he was with the CIA for many years before he quit and became an anti-war activist. He briefed the president and chaired the National Intelligence Estimate Committee back in the 80s. And he's going to talk today about Moscow's perspective on this imperialist war. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. I'm going to talk both about the Russian perspective, but also a key ingredient of all this is the Israeli perspective. I'm going to talk a little bit about the neocons, whom I define as those people who have great difficulty distinguishing between what they perceive as the strategic needs of Israel on the one hand and the strategic needs of the United States of America on the other. Now, as Senator Moynihan once said, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, and we ought to, grant the neocons the entitlement to their own opinion. It's just that I don't believe that a group of people who consider Israel's interests equally important to the United States' interests should be running U.S. foreign policy, and that's what's happening. Okay? Now, I can say that very freely. There are very few public figures that can say that freely without very, very bad retaliation. But I don't need any money. I'm not running for Congress. And I can say that this is the fly in the ointment. And that ought to be said right up front. And so I'm saying it right up front. This explains the whole U.S. outlook toward Iran. We were mentioned before that my colleagues actually stepped up to the plate after the debacle on Iraq and prepared an honest estimate on Iran, right? November 2007, unanimous, all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies with high confidence. Conclusion, Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. At the end of 2003, and has not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. Hello? Well, does that mean this whole thing is a charade? Are we demanding that Iran stop working on a weapon that they stopped working on in 2003? Yeah, it's a whole charade, folks. And why? Well, you know why I mentioned that at the outset of my remarks. Now, the situation in Syria, of course, was very, very complicated, and it looked like the tide was turning in favor of Assad toward the middle of 2013. And 2013 is a key year. Now, what was necessary? Well, it was necessary to tell our naive president that we had to put a red line in there. You got to put a red line. The Syrians have chemical weapons, and you better put a red line. And let's say, yeah, you're going to change your whole approach to this thing about U.S. military force, unless, if the red line is violated by the Syrian forces, okay? Namely, if they use or threaten to use chemical weapons. Well, guess what? There are attacks outside Damascus on August 21st, 2013, blamed on the Syrian government. Guess who perpetrated those attacks? Well, it's not entirely clear, but it is clear that it wasn't the Syrian government. What did Secretary of State John Kerry say?
Bashar al-Assad mounted these attacks outside Damascus.
How many times did he say that? 35 times. When did he say that? On the 30th of August, 2013. Now, luckily, a bunch of us got to the president. Not only us, but the British. The British had already refused to do a war, first time since 15, 16, I think, that the parliament turned down a British war.
You know, we talk about empire here, and for those of you who haven't told about my grandfather, my Irish grandfather, warning me about the British and the empire, you know, he said, Raymond, do you know why they say that the sun never sets on the British Empire? I said, yeah, I know. He said, you don't know. No, sit down and I'll tell you. The sun never sets on the British Empire because the good Lord would never trust the British in the dark. Well, suffice it to say that Obama was bailed out. Who was he bailed out by? A fellow named Vladimir Putin. Kerry, after Obama said he's not going to go to war without congressional approval, can you imagine? Without congressional approval? That sort of flies in the ointment of the Bush policy. But he said that, okay? Why did he say that? Because he knew he was being mousetrapped. So, what did he do? He called the French and said, you know, those fighter bombers you have on the tarmac, turn them off. We're not going to attack Syria tomorrow. Call the Israelis. Pull down, relax your defenses. We're not going to attack Syria. Wow, you know? Next day or 2 days later, Kerry gets up before Congress and he says, again, they violated the red line, we need to get the Syrians. And then, he adds that the moderate forces are winning. Well, that's the whole thing, guys. The moderate forces were not winning. Assad was winning. That's why it was necessary to mousetrap the president. Who mousetrapped the president? Well, whose interest was it? Whose interest was it to keep the pot boiling, to prevent any one side from winning? Guess whom? I mentioned that at the outset, Jody Ruderman, a new reporter for the New York Times, Jerusalem bureau chief, was sort of green, so she asked prominent Israeli officials, well, what do you think about, what would be a good solution, a good result to the Syrian thing? And they said, no outcome. And she said, I don't understand, what do you mean? No result, no outcome. And they told her, high Israeli officials, look, as long as we have Shia and Sunni killing each other off, it's just fine for us. So that's our objective, keep the... Now you said that openly, and it was, oddly, it was in the New York Times, so this is one time you could believe the New York Times. Anyhow, as soon as Kerry said those things, two things, blaming Assad for the chemical attacks, and then, saying the moderate forces are winning. There wasn't a soul in Washington or anywhere else that thought the moderate forces. What moderate forces? Even Obama has admitted that it's a charade to believe there were moderate forces of any consequence in Syria. So what do I say here? Well, there are a lot of things that are interesting, but perhaps most interesting from the Russian perspective is this. When Obama arrived in St. Petersburg for a G20 summit, the day after Kerry had told these big lies, the moderates are winning, Assad did the chemical attacks, Putin himself, and this is unique in my experience of 52 years watching Russia, okay, he said, Kerry vriot, on znayet, chto vriot, ette pechalne. Which means, Kerry lies. And he knows he's lying. This is really sad. So this whole thing was done behind Kerry's back, and Kerry is a neocon, pure and simple, okay? So the idea is that the head of the Soviet Union thought it necessary the day that the President of the United States arrived in Russia to say, look, you got a Secretary of State that lies to his teeth, and unfortunately, that's the case. So I want to finish up with something a little bit unusual, and that is simply this. What about Obama? Is he going to be mousetrapped or saved from being mousetrapped by some honest intelligence and some honest... The word is, as Cy Hirsch learned this, that the British got a sample of the sarin that was used. outside Damascus, right? And they ran it through their biological lab there at Port Down and found out it was not the same sarin that was in Syrian army government stocks. It was homemade, for God's sake, all right? So, anyhow, where does this leave us? Well, this leaves us with a president who is really being manipulated and happy to be manipulated. Look at Ukraine. Israel is playing a large role in that as well, and the neocons. But I want to say that the president, you know, there's a fellow I admire greatly, and that is Colonel Mo Davis. Now, Mo Davis was the chief prosecutor in Guantanamo for a while. And when he saw what was going on, he saw that Jim Haynes, the corrupt lawyer that Don Rumsfeld put in, head of the Defense Department lawyers, that he was going to be a supervisor, he quit. He said, look, he says, Haynes gave the approval for waterboarding. He said, it's okay. I'm not taking any orders from him. I quit. Now, why do I mention Mo Davis? Well, because he also commented a couple of years later, and being asked why Obama acts the way he does, he said, and I quote, there's a pair of testicles somewhere between the Capitol and the White House that fell off. That fell off President Obama after the inauguration. Okay. Now, a year and a half ago when I heard that someone nailed a pair of testicles into the cobblestones of Red Square, I said, oh, maybe they found them, maybe they found them, bring them back to Washington. But no, it was some berserk artist and it was his own testicles. So what we need to do is put some sort of, what do they call that drug, testosterone maybe, in the president's bloodstream. But for now, we have to face into the real problem, which, my friends, is the neocons. Thank you.
Okay, so our next speaker is Cynthia McKinney, sixth-term U.S. Congresswoman from Georgia, a Green Party candidate for president. She joined the Gaza Flotilla in 2009 and was arrested in Israel and imprisoned. She went to Libya in 2011, and when she came back, she wrote the book, The Illegal War on Libya. She did a lot of research on Libya and talked to a lot of people, and she was a real advocate for, unfortunately, abandoning a terrible policy, which, of course, was not abandoned. She also apparently just published an autobiography called Ain't Nothing Like Freedom. So I'm going to call Cynthia McKinney now to speak with you.
Thank you, and thanks to all of you. I am extremely pleased to be on this panel with my new friends, old friends, friends that don't mind getting into trouble. We're here because we all are interested in fighting empire, even at the Empire Hotel, right? So you guys know I've been, when the State Department was telling people in the Congress, don't send your staff because a trip was proposed for congressional staffers to go to Iraq to determine the impact of U.S. sanctions, I stepped up and sent my staff to Iraq. And then, of course, as Judy said, I've been to Gaza and Libya and Iraq and, Syria with Johnny. In the next few weeks, I'll be in the border area of Ukraine. I'll be in Free Ukraine, Donetsk. Wherever there is a problem that the United States is fomenting, I think we need to send witnesses there to tell the people the truth about what our government is doing. But I've also learned that no matter where you are, no matter what you do, you can resist. Whether it was me in the Georgia legislature asking for a point of personal privilege after staying up all night looking at the bombs falling in Iraq and thinking, really, this is beautiful. It looks like fireworks, but it was bombs and they were killing people. And I was outraged. And so I asked for a point of personal privilege. The speaker granted it to me. And when I got to the part of my speech with my remarks, when I said George Bush ought to be ashamed of himself, all of my colleagues got up and walked out on me. And so I just decided, okay, well, I wasn't talking to them anyway. And it was from that daring to dissent, that resistance, that place of resistance, that I ended up in Washington, in the Congress. Okay, well, now I'm here to tell you that I should have been here and introduced as Cynthia McKinney, PhD. But should have, but it ain't so yet. And the reason it ain't so is because I find myself resisting empire even in academia, at the most liberal institution probably in the entirety of the United States, Antioch University. But the problem is, I have written 300 pages on the fantastic transformational parhesiastic leadership of Hugo Chavez. And I went to Seattle, Washington in January of this year, which Don knows very well, to defend my dissertation. The defense went extremely well. My committee said, yay, 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 you are now a PhD, right? I get on the plane, and before I land, the news of Scott Brown's incarceration hits the airwaves, because he dared to use WikiLeaks documents. And those of you who know me know that I specialize in those kinds of documents from the COINTELPRO papers. And understanding what the United States government is actually capable of doing based on what it has actually done before. And so when the WikiLeaks documents came out, I said, this is a treasure trove. I am going to use those documents. I use the exact same documents that Scott Brown used, including the Stratfor emails that were complaining that Hugo Chavez would not fire on, would not allow the Venezuelan, the Bolivarian military to fire on their own people. You didn't hear that, did you? Because in those very same WikiLeaks documents, they proclaim, well, thank goodness the media didn't really tell the whole story and led their readers, they called out Associated Press, and led the readers to believe that Hugo Chavez's military had actually fired on the Venezuelan people. Well, now that has some import. Because what was the lie that was told about the Jamahiriya in Libya? That the Libyan government had fired on their own people. What's the lie that's being told about Syria? One of the things that we know from research is that if the lie works, they won't hesitate to use it again. But anyway, I diverge from my point. And my point is, with my limited amount of time, that Hugo Chavez was able to change the world for people that he, that whose world needed desperately to be changed. And it is the power of leadership. And that is what we actually are fighting. We are fighting evil, nefarious, malintended leadership. And how do we fight that? With our own leadership. We know the power of leaders' vision and voices. We know it from Fidel, Daniel Ortega, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa, Cristina Kirchner, Salvador, Sanchez, and others. But there are also different ways that leaders with vision give us to resist. And so we are looking at a brave new world that is being created now with the new Silk Road that will challenge the U.S. pivot to Asia. There's BRICS, that challenges IMF and the World Bank. There's the Eurasian Economic Union, and then there's Chavez's UNASUR that challenges the US Fourth Fleet. So there's something that is underfoot right now. This is a, it's just as Dr. King said in his final speech, he said that he was glad to be alive in the 20th century because people were standing up saying they don't want to be free. And so we see that happening all over the world. The world is not waiting for us in the United States. And the young people who have taken to our streets now protesting police terrorism are not waiting on us either. The only thing I want to leave you with is this. This brave new world that is being created, we have not only a responsibility, we must be a part of the construction of the vision of that new world. And it starts and it ends. Even though we resist where we are, how we can, no matter what it takes, but it also starts and ends in Washington, D.C. And that's where we need to train our eyes like a laser on the leadership and the lack thereof of the current regime. And we don't have to ask other folk to be our leaders. We need to send people from this room to Washington, D.C., and then we will be able to count on them to do the right thing instead of begging already bought people to do the wrong thing.
Finally, I want to introduce to you Bill Doris. He's been working against racism and for a better world I'd say his entire life. In the 90s, he worked with the Russian labor movement. In 2009, he went on a convoy to Gaza. And he is going to talk to you about some of the driving forces that are taking us into these wars. Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny. I was with Cynthia in Syria. I had the honor to go with Cynthia to Gaza after she was rescued from the ship that was captured by the Israelis on the high seas, kidnapped along with Irish Nobel Prize laureate Mairead McGuire and others, and taken to prison in Israel. And we called up the White House and said, protested, and the White House said, "Can you send us some more information?" As if they didn't know that a former U.S. congressperson and others had been seized on the high seas. Imagine had that been done by Iran or North Korea or Venezuela or a dozen other countries.
Right.
Cynthia said, "We're here fighting empire in the Empire Hotel. It's also the Meadowlands Hotel." Does anyone know what yesterday was?
Yes.
The birthday of John Brown, and what else? The 9th of May. Does anyone know why I'm wearing this ribbon? It was the 70th anniversary of the defeat of Nazi Germany when the Soviet army liberated Berlin. And the red flag, Soviet flag was raised over the Reichstag. It marked the beginning of the end of the bloodiest war in history, a war in which maybe 60 million people died at a low-end estimate, and of those, one of every three was a citizen of the former Soviet Union. And yesterday in Moscow, there was a huge Victory Day parade, and And the president of China, Xi Jinping, was there because China had took the second largest number of casualties in that war out of a much bigger population, of course. My president Maduro of Venezuela was there. Raul Castro was there. Kim Jong-un, the president of North Korea, was supposed to be there. There was a last minute, he didn't go, but North Korea was also on the front lines. That was a country occupied by Japan. Even Germany was there. Who was not there was the United States, Israel, the U.S., which claims children are taught today the U.S. won that war. But in fact, the U.S. boycott and the boycott by the U.S. and its allies of the Victory Day Parade in Moscow was an aspect of what's called the New Cold War, is being referred to as the New Cold War, which, like the old Cold War, in which millions died in Vietnam, in Korea, in the Middle East, in Central America, is not very cold. For the first time since the end of World War II, bombs and missiles are actually raining down on cities in eastern Ukraine, on Donetsk and Lugansk, on schools and hospitals and housing and villages. And the men behind the guns are the direct ideological descendants of those Ukrainians who allied with Adolf Hitler in World War II, except this time the U.S. government is on their side, not only politically, but is arming them. In fact, since the end of the so-called Cold War, the United States, which was told the end of history there'd be a peace dividend that would benefit everyone, the United States has been at war again and again and again. In Yugoslavia, in Iraq, a nonstop war against Iraq, Libya, and now proxy wars in Syria, in Venezuela, in Ukraine, in Yemen, which is a U.S. war. And for 54 days last summer, we watched horrible days. We watched as the full might of the U.S., the latest weapons of the U.S. military were unleashed by the world's largest aircraft carrier, the so-called State of Israel, the Jewish state in the Levant, which, those are the words of Alexander Haig, who said, Israel is our largest, is the largest American aircraft carrier in the world and the only one that can't be sunk, unleashed its full power on the world's largest prison, which is 1.5 million people imprisoned on this small strip of land called the Gaza Strip, people who used to live in the rest of Palestine who were forced out at gunpoint into this prison where they're being kept by Israel and the Egyptian military regime. And this was a U.S. war too, U.S. planes, U.S.-made planes dropping U.S.-made bombs and missiles on a defenseless population entirely paid for by the United States. So what's going on? Why? Well, let's remember that after the Cold War, after World War II, why is the U.S. still at war when there's no enemy? I mean, who are the U.S.'s enemies? You have states as diverse as the Islamic State of Iran, Republic of Iran, and secular Syria, and then Iraq, which the U.S. had supported against Iran at one time, and Libya, and you have socialist aspiring states like Cuba and China, and completely diverse, and Venezuela, the states of South America, completely diverse array of enemies. But let's remember that for World War II, which is the bloodiest war of the last century, perhaps the bloodiest war in history, was not a tragedy for everyone. For the Wall Street, the people we now call the 1%, the Wall Street bankers, many of whom supported Hitler before the war, it was the best thing that ever happened, because the destruction caused by that war left the U.S. at the center of the world economy. It made the dollar the world's reserve currency, and it created the giant military-industrial complex that still dominates our lives today. Now, that status of the dollar as the world's reserve currency was backed by gold. Nixon had to take it off the gold standard in 1973 because of the cost of the war in Vietnam, and the only thing that maintained its status was a deal that Henry Kissinger made with Saudi Arabia. Under which oil reserve and Saudi Arabia and the then Shah of Iran and the other Gulf kingdoms, under which if they nationalized their oil, the revenues of Arabian oil and then Iranian oil that before the revolution would go into Wall Street banks and the oil would be sold for dollars. And these very regimes, these horrible monarchies that the U.S. is allied with, like Saudi Arabia, their thrones had been saved only 6 years earlier when Israel went to war against Egypt and Syria in the 67 war. That is was basically a war against Arab nationalism. The answer to what the U.S.'s war against the world, which is what it is, cannot be found in the individual character of the regimes under attack. It can be found in the nature of the U.S. economic system itself, which is imperialism, which is not a policy, it's a system. monopoly capital, and another word for imperialism, as it was described by Lenin and others, is monopoly capitalism. And what is monopoly about? Monopoly is not about restricting. It is about restricting supply. It's about it's a war. It's a way to. It's a weapon to try to control the uncontrolled overproduction that is in itself a product of the capitalist system. Sorry, 2 minutes. Okay.
One and a half.
All right. So what we're having is basically the only thing that has assured the status of the United States at the center of the world economy is war, destruction. It's not even about hegemony or stability. It's not about oil. The United States 2 years ago replaced Russia and Saudi Arabia as the world's largest oil and gas producer. And the many said, well, energy self-sufficiency, that'll solve the problem. But it was the destruction of the oil reserves of Iraq, the destruction of the Iraq state owned oil industry, and the sanctions against Iran, and the bombing of Libya that made the whole fracking industry in this country profitable. That would not exist without that. And now, of course, we have the Obama regime pursuing a different policy, trying to wreck the economies of countries from Venezuela to Russia to Iran with the flow of cheap oil. And there's some difference, a bit of a fight going on over that, and that's what's behind Netanyahu and the Likud's alliance with the Republicans against Obama. But basically, the fact is that the U.S. monopoly capitalist system has no room for the productive capacity of most of humanity. It has no room for the African Union. It has no room for the Shanghai Economic Cooperation Organization. It has no room for the alliance, the Bolivian alliance of our Americas. It has no room for the economic blocs arising around the world. It has to assure, and can only assure by force, that all avenues of economic life in this country, in the world, go through Wall Street. It has no room for them, just like it has no room for the people of Detroit and the people of Baltimore and the people of the cities around this country. That's also a war. They're they're waging a war against production, against development, against the possibility of abundance. And our struggle is to be with the people of the world to fight, because there is absolutely no reason in this world today, with our productive capacity that our labor has produced over centuries, the technology we have, for one person to be hungry, for one person to be uneducated, for one person to be without a home. And that's the struggle of us against them today. Thank you.
So just having heard that, I find myself wanting to turn it upside down and say, the people of Detroit, the people of the world, the people of the cities of the United States, the people, the BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and all the peoples of the world ultimately have no room for Wall Street.
That's right. During my years of reading Pravda and Izvestia, there was one term that I thought really ridiculous. It was in Russian, Volstritskiye kravopitsy, translated into English, Wall Street bloodsuckers. And I used to say, oh, come on, you know, Soviet propaganda, Wall Street bloodsuckers. Now, who would have thought they had it nailed right on the nail, huh? Okay. So that's behind a lot of this stuff. We have to recognize that. And in cooperation with them, we have the Washington Post and the New York Times that don't tell us the truth on things like Ukraine. Now, somebody says, what can we do about that? I think New York Times is right across the river, isn't it? Or somewhere in this vicinity here. And the Washington Post down where I live. We ought to picket those places. There's lots of stuff on the fascism that's going on and it's never reported in our media.
For the question on BRICS, BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. I don't see the United States anywhere in it, and I don't want to see the United States in it. So now, if you can give me a rationale after this is over on why the United States should be present in an institution that was founded to counter the United States, then I'm willing to listen to you, even though I may not agree with you. Past Glass-Steagall, I mean, you know, that's all right. Yeah, we need to do that. We need to do anything and everything. I also say let's get rid of the Fed. You know, Rand Paul is talking about audit the Fed. Well, we need to do more than audit the Fed. We need to go back to the constitutional mandate of the Congress and repeal what was passed in December in 19, whatever it was, 13 or whatever, that established the Fed. I say we should encourage our government as well as other governments to walk away from the debt. It's a fake debt anyway. Ukraine, I've been posting on Ukraine on my little feeble Facebook page. I've been posting. There's a gentleman who's done a wonderful video series that really all it does is just shows the bombs falling and the damage that's done and the people who are hurt, killed, or maimed. And really, it doesn't need to say anything more. And so that actually is what encouraged me or inspired me to want to go there. So I'm going to go there, and to the extent that that visit will put more focus on what's going on in Ukraine, then I'm pleased for that. But the bottom line on all of this is we need somebody in Washington, D.C. who will pull the plug on the funding for all of this stuff. Just say, no, you want this, you can't have it until we get this. That's it. And the power in the congressional office, I have people who are calling me right now for everything. Family and Children's Services want to take their children away. And I'm talking about people calling me from New York City. And so we don't have very many people that we push the button for and vote who actually respond to us. We got to change that scenario. We have to change that equation. And we have to stop falling for the hurting mentality. So that's why I was extremely pleased to see the Bruce Dixon piece in Black Agenda Report exposing Bernie Sanders. Well, I mean, it's obvious. I mean, I don't know why you want me to say the obvious. The obvious is that we don't, you know, I've never voted for any one of those so-called free trade agreements up there. And I'm against them all. I've signed petitions to the extent that petitions do anything, but the petitions don't take the place. Look at what we just witnessed between the difference between Ferguson and Baltimore. Now, you've got Ferguson that is a town that is majority black, but the elected officials don't represent, nor the Governor Jay Nixon represents those folk in Ferguson. And so you get the result that you got. Now you have an anti-establishment candidate in the name of, I think her name is Michelle Mosby. Marilyn Mosby. She ran against an incumbent. She was outspent. She was not endorsed by anyone of any note. And she won. And now she's carrying out, at least there's an indictment, which is so hard to get. It's night and day, and it shows the difference between when you vote for people who are status quo insiders who think they can sit down in a back room and cut a deal off of your back, or you vote for someone who's gonna stand with you, who comes from you. And so that's why I say that in this room, we have leaders who need to be policy makers. Our quarrel is with the policy. And therefore, if all of our folk that we entrust our votes to sell us out in the end, let's put somebody in this room whom we know in as a policymaker and get a different result. That's my point. Thank you. Yeah. Let me. Okay. Let me get my PhD in hand. I've had to go back. I didn't tell you the whole story. I got to go back and redo the whole dissertation, taking out the WikiLeaks documents. It's been a mess for the last few months, but hopefully I'm down to like the last 2 weeks. Next time you see me, we'll be able to talk about that. And so much love to Lynn. Oh my God, it's wonderful to see you.
Glass-Steagall, I don't care. They bombed Korea and Vietnam, and Glass-Steagall was in effect. They took the dollar off the standard, off the gold standard, when Glass-Steagall was in effect. It doesn't mean a whole lot to me. I'm glad about the question about the TPPA, and that I think the answer to that is similar to what Cynthia said about BRICS, because when Obama was pushing the TPPA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, he was saying how the U.S. is an Asian country, and we're not going to leave there. You know, we're part of this. But of course, the U.S. has no business in Asia, and you cannot separate the TPPA, which is going to be an engine of destruction like NAFTA. You cannot separate it from the military Pacific shift against China. And the answer is we have the U.S. to get out of Asia and Africa and the Middle East and the Arab world and South America, Central America. And North America, we need to, because we're one with the people of the world. That's the real issue. I think the main thing on the revisionism that Nellie asked about is the same things children are being taught here today. I'm supposed to go on RT about it later today. How the U.S. won World War II single-handedly, we've got to educate, but mostly we got to build. I mean, the mass movement is the struggle. I'm all for. I'd love to see Cynthia run, but it's the mass movement, it's the struggle in the streets that has to be behind any political change. It's what's happening in Baltimore, what's happening in Ferguson. We got to build the links. Last December, some of us, Joe Lombardo, myself, Margaret Kimberly, were in Moscow and at an anti-imperialist conference, and we went out and with our Russian host, we picketed the U.S. embassy with pictures of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. You know, that's the kind of solidarity needs to be built. We need to do what we can to show those in struggle, to the extent they don't know it or they're discovering them, is that the links between our struggles. This ribbon is banned in Ukraine today. Elderly veterans of the Soviet Army have been beaten up on the streets by fascist gangs. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian puppet government has passed a law banning communism, when it was communists that led the struggle against fascism in not only the Soviet Union, but across Europe and Asia during that war. And they equate it with fascism. Well, that's a lie, because they themselves are fascists, and their battalions carry neo-Nazi insignia, and they carried neo-Nazi insignia a year ago this month when they burned 60 to 70 people. They burned down the trade union hall in Odessa. We have guests here from Odessa, and murdered 60 to 70 people, and those who jumped out of the windows were beaten to death on the streets. That's what the United States is supporting in Ukraine. This is historical revisionism. It's fascism. It's support for fascism, because fascism is increasingly the only answer of a corrupt, decaying system that has no more place in this world.
There's a person here in our presence who was in Odessa when the fascists did their dirty deeds back over a year ago. Irina, would you stand up? Representative from Odessa. Now, fascism lives, folks. We have creeping fascism right here in this country. But you know what? There's great hope. And what I would suggest is that you tune in to the YouTube version of the parade on Red Square yesterday, where you will see crack troops from India, crack troops from the PLA, the Army of China, marching through Red Square. The people who are isolated, you know, there's a supreme irony that Obama wanted to isolate Russia. Well, you got a big chunk of humanity there just out of China and India. And who's missing? It's Obama and the people who dance to his tune. Now, Angela Merkel was not there yesterday, but she's there today. That's progress, okay? She said, Mother, may I? And Obama said, no, you may not go to the parade. And she said, well, I think I'll go the next day. Maybe I can say I couldn't book a flight or I couldn't get it, you know. And so she's there today. That's progress. So who's isolated? It's the fascists that are isolated with people who have any kind of memory, and it's the imperialists. Thank you.
So I think one of the things that's emerged from this discussion is that there's a multipolar world developing out there economically in terms of alliances, and it respectful organizations and countries respectful of one another. And it's the United States that stood down. It's the United States that was asked to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and was refused. It's the United States that cannot join the BRICS because the BRICS are an economic trade alliance that's actually going around the dollar, so why would the United States want to participate in that? And so there's a new world emerging. And sadly, we have to work hard if we want to participate, because we're going to have to change some things here. And so on that note, I'd like to thank all of our speakers who reflect on the situation now and what it might be.